My name's Henry. I'm an alcoholic. I'm putting this watch up here. I heard somebody the other day say, coming out of a meeting, and somebody on the outside asked him if the speaker was finished. And the man said, yeah, he's finished. He just hadn't stopped talking. I try to be conscious of time, which means I'll probably run at it. I came in to this program on September, as close as I can figure it, September 2, 1981. And I came in here primarily because I was convinced that I was losing my mind. And I'm fairly well convinced that was the case. You know, I happen to be a lawyer, and when you go into a courtroom where you see somebody in general district court wearing a coat and tie on a fairly constant basis, my analysis was, damn, he looks good for somebody who's in here every time. What I found out later was that he was the manager of Safeway and he was collecting or prosecuting bad check cases. But that's where I was. I could brown out in the midst of trying the case, and have to sort of sit on my hands and not hold it up and say, Judge, where are we? But that's what brought me here. And I expect that's the thing that keeps me here, is I was really convinced that the next stop for me was some sort of funny farm. And I came in here, I went to see somebody in Charlottesville. I have an ex-brother-in-law who's a very good friend. And I told him I was having all of these problems. And anything that I did just trashed. And I said, I just don't know what to do. And he said, oh, I'll call somebody for you. She'll tell you what to do, and she'll send you on to the right person. So I went over to Charlottesville to see this person. It was at that time the David C. Wilson clinic. It's gone through various metamorphoses, and I don't know whether it's still a drying out joint or not. But it was a 28-day program. And I went over there, sat down with this lady, and she tricked me. She started asking me questions that were on something called the Michigan Alcohol Screening Test. And I was brought up to tell the truth, so I told the truth. And after I'd answered those 20 questions, she said, I think you're an alcoholic. And that was the first time it ever occurred to me. I lived in a place where it was really more convenient for me to drink than to be sober. There was more control out there. And so I thought about that for a couple of days. And then the person I had known outside the program, who was inside the program, my then wife called, and he took me to my first meeting. His name is Peter. And he made me get there on my own. And that first meeting was sort of extraordinary to me. Now, I'm a snob. I've been given everything that anybody could ask for in life, and brought up in the right places and so forth and so on. So I went into that meeting expecting to see people like him and the rest of the country club crowd there. And I was greeted by a lady who had no front teeth. Very nice, but she just didn't have any front teeth. And another person in that meeting said that nobody ever drank with him twice. He had just been released from the Georgia State prison system. And you could look at him and see why. Yet, what he had to impart to me is something that's still with me. Unfortunately, he first froze his, he went back out, first froze his feet off, and then ended up dead by a green box. But as I told his daughters, he still lives with me and lives with a number of other people in the program because of what he had to say. And he was a good person, and he just had an unfortunate habit. He couldn't stay sober. But at the end of that first meeting, I was walking out the door, and Peter said, "Will you come and go into Culpeper tomorrow night?" And I said, "No, I'm way too busy to go to Culpeper." And he asked me a question. He said, "Well, how much time did you spend a day drinking?" And that was sort of a stumper for me, because I no longer had a real excuse not to go, because I spent a great deal of time, especially at night, drinking. So I went to Culpeper that night. And, of course, I had come in here on the 30-day approval program. I'd look it over for 30 days and decide whether or not this was really for me. And the problem was, I kept hearing people who felt the same way I did, who were scared, who felt they had no self-esteem. And it seemed to me every meeting I went to, I would pick up another person who was in the same place I was. And pretty soon, I started to identify in. And Peter taught me two things. One was, go to a meeting. The other was, when you're in a meeting, speak. And I can't tell you how many times I was in a meeting because I didn't want to be in a meeting. I spoke, although it was not going to do any good. And of course, Peter came to rue the day that he had told me that. But nevertheless, I did what he said. I went to a meeting every night, and I think 99 was there, but it was kind of not really talked about that much the way it is now. Or at least I didn't hear it. And the other thing was learning how to say something. And the first month or so that I was in this program, by the end of that, I knew more about AA than I'll ever know again. I'd also picked out the steps that I needed to work. And I was back in that phase of being 10 feet tall and bulletproof. And thankfully, there were people around who kept me coming back. not telling me to, but suggesting that I do that. And I think one lesson that I heard again was listening to a speaker who said this is the only program that he knew of where what you did was to talk about yourself. The other person didn't matter. If he wanted to hear it or she wanted to hear it, that's fine. But it wasn't my duty to get it across to him. And that's the simplicity of this program. I don't have any right to tell anybody what they need to do. And it's the only thing I have to do is to talk about me. So that at the end of that first month, and this is probably strong kept me in this program, the wheels came off. My then wife decided she'd had enough, and she didn't like me any better sober than drunk. So she suggested that we have a trial separation, which I went along with, and I was in the process of moving out, and suddenly I noticed, this was in November, I think, my summer clothes were coming down out of the attic. So I kind of got the idea this was not trial. And that's when everything broke bad, so to speak. And I would go to meetings, and I would have to recite all of the terrible things that she was doing, both to me, probably my children, and certainly talking about me in front of other people. And I would come to meetings, and I would talk about it. And I got back some really good advice. Keep coming back. And, you know, thankfully I didn't get any advice as to what to do. So, you know, you get into, at least being new in this program, I'd get into these situations and I'd come to a meeting and I'd want to get some real advice as to what I should do. And then I get this crap about keep coming back. And I think behind my back, people used to say, well, some people are sicker than others. And of course, everything I had to say, A, was valid, and B, was important. And C, you just didn't understand. This is something that needs to have some attention to it. And I'm unique. And they refused to buy into the fact that I was unique. And people like Bill Johnson just kept me coming here. I had started drinking fairly late. First time I drank, I got sick as a dog for 3 days, and I didn't drink again for 2 years. But then I discovered the magic, and here I came. And I went through college. Well, actually, I went through high school with the philosophy, if I didn't pass it this year, I'd pass it the next. And as a result, I was there for 5 years and never did graduate. But in those days, if your body was warm, you could get into the University of Virginia. So I went there. In the first 2 years that I was there, I had two grades, A or F. And the courses I didn't like, I got an F on. The ones I liked, I got an A in. And strangely enough, I was never on probation because I always had enough in those days what they called quality points to keep me off probation. And it really wasn't until the summer going into my junior year in college that I decided that maybe it would be a good idea to study. I was taking a summer school course then in Spanish, and I just racked up a 42 on the first test. So that was a turning point for me as far as college went. And back then, there was not, in my family, you were supposed to get a graduate degree. Well, if you didn't know what you wanted to do, you'd go to law school. And so off I went to law school. And they used to say, or back then they said, the University of Virginia was a real play school. Well, I found one better. Washington Lee University was a true play school. And I just played my way through law school. I'd go up and or go to dinner, and I was really going to study that night and read all this stuff I hadn't read, and somebody would mention Hollins or Sweetbriar, and off I went. And in those days, these schools were single sex. So somehow I managed to graduate from W&L. And I got lucky. When I got out of law school, I got a job with the man who was president of the Board of Bar Examiners for 40 years. And he taught me law. He taught me a good many things. One was, don't presume that in Southwest Virginia that they were on the Union side. Jeb Stewart had grown up in his family's house, and apparently at the Battle of Chancellorsville, that's where one-armed so-and-so and one-legged so-and-so lost their limbs. And because something had happened to Jackson, and the soldiers knew it, and so they'd put Stewart in charge, and Stewart was out trying to rally the troops, and the people from Withville knew who he was and essentially went to his rescue and got the rest of them moving. But that's way off point. So I became an itinerant lawyer. I had about a 3-year life in any community. I went from Alexandria to Withville. That was the equivalent going from Alexandria to Hartford, Connecticut. And I stayed there for about 3 years, and things got a little hot, so it was time to leave. And I went to the eastern shore of Virginia, where nobody knew me. My children were born in the hospitals are the furthest away from each other in Virginia. One was born in Bristol, the other was born in Nassauwattocks. But I went there, and things were beginning to catch up with me. But I still held out. I still had a good 10 or 12 years left in me, most of which I'm not very cognizant of. If you want to know what I did with my children, ask my daughter, because I wasn't there. I may have been there physically, but I was not there mentally. I mean, Caroline can tell me more things that I don't know about while they were growing up. Of course, she never forgets anything. I made the unfortunate mistake of moving out of the house that she and her mother shared on her 14th birthday. I think she's gotten over it, but for a while it was a contentious issue. So I just got to that point where I didn't know what else to do. And I'm convinced that for me, I came in here and I stay here because I did not want to lose my mind. And it still goes and comes, but that scared me. And I would say that after about 10, 20 days, I identified in. Hell, everybody had the same thing I did. Had the same problems I had. Had the same fears. I stuck with it, survived the 30-day wait, and kept on going, and have kept on going. I have had times in this program when I've been profoundly depressed, and I think from the 13th year to about the 17th year, I was profoundly depressed. I knew that I was going to end up a street person without any money, any family, any anything. And Peter had the same problem, and so we finally kind of conquered that one together with the idea, well, if it happens, it happens. And so I operate on that today. Yes, it could happen. The likelihood is not as great as I thought it was then. So when I came in here, there were certain people here that I learned to listen to. One was a farmer who had about an eighth grade education, and the other was a car mechanic. And here, I'm a lawyer. Why in the hell should I be listening to them? But they had more wisdom than probably anyone, with the exception of one or two other people that I've ever known, that gave me what this program had to offer and kept me not with any direction to be here, but with the idea that if I kept coming back, I would have what they had. And I can assure you, in the early days, there was no way that was going to happen. Because just because I got sober didn't mean that my life cleared up. Shortly after being in the program, being separated, I went into a default. I think it was $120,000. And I moaned about that in meetings. And the third thing that happened, I was holding out this hope that we were going to get back together again. And my then wife had a bad automobile accident, and she was in the hospital for over a month. And during that period of time, I took care of the animals and the children. At that point, I had gotten the animals that she didn't want before she was in the accident. There was a cat, and Judy still remembers the cat, and a dog. And then Caroline and her mother had a falling out, so Caroline came to live with me. And she wasn't getting any guidance. She almost flunked out of Orange County High School. And thankfully, there was a fund around to send her to another school, and she did well, got through college and so forth, and then the wheels came off for her. But I look back on those days, and they were gray. You know, there was not much humor, except when somebody else spoke. But as far as I was concerned, there wasn't. And my first anniversary was a memorable occasion because the person who was running it fell on my cake. So we had... the cake was grass and cake. And then some people named Harry and Florence showed up who had moved down from Washington, D.C. And Harry had the flock. And Harry told his people what meeting they were going to and what they were going to do and what they weren't going to do. And I used to go to these meetings, and I was on, Kevin Reynolds and I were on the outside. We were the guinea pigs. They were told, watch us, we'll get drunk. And so I think both of us got in a good bit of stride by being damned if we didn't let Harry show. But Judy said I would come home just fuming. And finally I figured out what Harry's problem was. He was doing and controlling the people that I thought that I ought to be controlling. Because I knew better. And once I could get that, I could listen to him. And he had a habit. He always selected who was going to chair the meeting. And he always was called on last. And so you got a critique of what everybody had said. And special time reserved for either Kevin and I who were there. And I used to just come home madder than a hornet. But when I finally started to listen and could get rid of the messenger and listen to the message, then I began to hear some good things from Harry. And he moved away. But I think he was here for 5, 8 years. And he was the perfect sponsor for somebody new in the program. Because I don't know about you, when I came in here, I had no idea what to do, where to go, how to do anything. And Harry just took right over and told his people what they were going to do and what they were going to read and so forth and so on, who they would talk to. And he kept these people sober, which I figured was my job. I had to learn the most important thing about this program. It's not about the person I'm talking to, other than the fact if that person chooses to listen, that person can listen. The important thing for me to realize is that what I do in this program is what I do. And I don't have any right to tell anybody what to do. And if you really want to get under an alcoholic's skin, tell them what to do. So I have learned over the years, you know, this white-knuckle grip type thing, that all I've got to offer anybody is what I say. And so, if it's what they, whatever they want. And it makes the program very simple, because I'm not responsible for anybody but myself. And I can't get anybody sober. And I can't keep anybody sober, only myself. So, I'm a lousy sponsor, because I refuse to direct people. So I don't have many pigeons. The pigeons I have have had long-time sobriety in this program, and they know when to just slough me off. But if somebody wants to get drunk, they're going to get drunk. And I remember Bill saying, and I'm sure this occurred with me about a month into the program, alcoholics cannot stand success, and especially new alcoholics. And for me, when I started to feel success, when I started to feel that I didn't need to hear what these people had to say over and over again, when I was going to meetings and hearing the same thing over and over again, and sometimes leaving meetings madder than I was when I got there, I had to learn to realize that nobody can tell me what to do. Now, they're perfectly at liberty to make suggestions, and I wouldn't be here if it were not for the people who were here before me. But they gave me the gift of God's grace to be here and to be up here speaking. I'm trying to put it into words, and I really can't. But, you know, this program is one where you don't tell people what to do. You tell people what your story is. And I heard an Episcopal minister once say, in our church we call them ministers, not pastors, although some of them are trying to change that image. At any rate, he said, spirituality is God-given. Religion is the invention of man. Spirituality teaches the world how to hold hands. Religion divides us. And, well, I still go to church occasionally. I don't go in the summer, because church meets at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'm over here at 10 o'clock in the morning getting ready to go home. But the meeting is far more important to me than the church. But that's just me. There are other people who get a great deal out of going to church, and if that keeps them sober, fine. Whatever it takes to stay sober is what somebody needs to do. And in this program, I keep hearing that there are two things that people get bent out of shape on. And their sayings are, yeah, but I'm different. And the other is, they said. And I had a hard time with what they said, because I thought it made a difference. And I had to learn that what they said is what they said. I couldn't keep them from saying what they said. I just didn't have to operate on it. And in social situations before, I would go into a room, put up a periscope, and decide what I was supposed to be in that particular situation, because I had no idea. And so I would be that. And so they said it was important to me when I came in here, because what they said made the difference between my life being a success and not being a success. And so they got me where they wanted me. My life wasn't a success, and I was miserable. But it was really important for me to get away from they said. About the only person right now who tells me what to do is sitting in this room. And I've learned to obey. Because she's usually right. Which was an amazing thing for me. That anybody could tell me I shouldn't do something, and for them to be right and me to be wrong. I mean, when I came in here, my thinking was in one direction. And it had to come 180 degrees. And I would go out of meetings, and I would hear something in a meeting, and I'd say, is that so? Because I thought the opposite was true. And back then, the meetings were somewhat small, and we usually went to, it was then the Dairy Queen in Culpeper. You could get all the coffee you wanted, and if you dared eat, you could eat. But the food had been laid out there at 10 o'clock in the morning, and it was about 9 o'clock at night. But I had the opportunity to ask people, you know, is what so-and-so said in the meeting correct? Usually it was. My thinking was wrong. And I had to learn how to rethink. And probably the most important thing for me to learn, and old Bill taught it to me, he said, humility is the willingness to learn, to become teachable, is what he used to say. And it took me a long time to quit being right and to listen. But I can't learn anything if I already know it. And if I already know it, I have cut you off. And I can't listen to something that you may say that is really important for me to hear. And I'm slowly getting to that point in politics. That's another story. You know, I'm very successful in politics simply because the people I run against are dumber than hell. It's not because I'm a politician. My wife's a politician. I'm not. But those are things that have been given to me that I couldn't have achieved on my own. It always comes back to God's grace. And all that I can ever do is become willing. I can't change myself. All I can do is become willing to change. And for me, the only way to become willing to change is not to know anything. And that's hard for a lawyer. because they know everything. You know, it's sort of a lawyer's mind, and I suppose somebody else's, is it knows nothing, but it's an authority on everything. And that's the way I operate. You know, somebody would say something, I had to top that, always, true or not true. And it's nice not to have to sit around and top what people are saying. I got a friend, he doesn't have a problem with alcohol, but I have never heard a story told in his presence that he didn't have to top. And that's a lot of work. And it's a lot of unnecessary work. One of the other lessons I had to learn was that not to lie when the truth would serve me just as well. You know, I just lie for no damn reason at all. Simply because I might get caught up on something. And that was very, very hard for me to do, was learn not to embellish. But again, from where I came from, anything that came out of my mouth had to be better than, because I was not a very good person and a pretty much low self-esteem, the only way that I could try to achieve that is to have something that topped everybody's story. Now, if you really want to demonstrate your ignorance, do it. Because I remember people just sort of walking away from me and shaking their heads, and drunk or sober. So, Caroline's sponsor, among other things that she said, one was that if she had looked like me, she'd have been in AA a long time ago. And she used to, she could irritate the hell out of me. Because, again, she told truth. And that's the reason that Caroline came out of charter, and she got lined up with Lynn, I think, in the first day, because I knew she needed a sponsor who wasn't going to take a damn thing off of her, and they were going to meetings, and that was that. And Lynn had been trained in the Harry and Florence mode, and so she was an excellent first-year sponsor, and she's continued to be Caroline's sponsor. Sometimes mine. But I just wanted to be like everybody else. And that's what alcohol did for me. It made me feel on the inside like other people looked on the outside. And it essentially filled all the cracks in my personality. And so I'd start drinking. I'd get to be 10 feet tall. I'd get to be bulletproof and start running my mouth about things I had no idea what I was talking about. But it was profound. I can remember sitting up with a guy one night in Whitfield. I think we sat up till 3 o'clock in the morning, and by the time we left, we had figured out everything that was wrong with Whitfield, with County, Virginia, and the United States. Went home, woke up the next day, I couldn't remember a damn thing that we had said. And that was just the way my life worked. I mean, I just really was not here. And so it's kept me here. Really, I may run out of gas. And this has been very disjointed because I didn't know what I was going to say before I came here, and I'm not sure what I've said since, but 15 minutes after, or when I sit down, I will remember all the things I meant to say. It's sort of like double dipping. Don't come back after me because it will be stupid. But one of the things that was different for me when I first came in here was there was none of this, what I call friends meeting style, of letting people decide whether or not they wanted to talk. Everybody got called on. They had an election. They didn't have to talk. They could pass, but you got a chance. And I still adhere to that because I can't tell you how many meetings I came into where I knew that if I talked about it, it wasn't going to do any good. And 9 times out of 10, it was exactly what I needed to do. So you get a lot of talk from me in a meeting. And because it goes back to what Peter told me. Trying to say something. Because this is a quest. This is the finish line we were talking about this morning, and of course Earl is famous for the finish line. But you never cross it. And I was thinking that most of the people that I've known who come into this program, gone back out and come back, really the first thing they'll tell you is I quit going to meetings. So even though I have the time that I have in this program, I do not want to quit going to meetings. I may not go to meetings on a daily basis the way I used to, but I know the value of it because too many people have been able to demonstrate for me the value of it. Besides that, I don't want to go through another first year in this program. I mean, that was just plain awful. Not only was everything going wrong in my life, but I was on that rocket ride that went up and down. And it was a rocket that came down as fast as it went up. And one day I'd have this program licked. I'd heard something in a meeting. And that was the answer. So I'd go home and I would say to myself, I'm going to work that. I said, this is the answer to the program. If I do this, things will work out fine and I'll be a success here. And they might last a day, most of the time about an hour. And I'd be right back where I was. Because I was trying to make my program somebody else's program who was successful. And I'm convinced today everybody in this room has their own program. Just as everybody in this room has their own God. Some of us aren't sure what that is. And I remember a number of years ago being at a meeting in Rapidan, and a guy named Woody came through trying to get back to New Orleans. And Woody was one of these people who'd sort of been a star in AA. He was really funny, really good speaker, stay to Bill Wilson's house, the whole deal. Woody's wife died. And Woody ended up in Maine about $63,000 short of the money he had. I don't know if he ever got back there. But, when I heard that, how can somebody who's got 35 years in the program, has done all of this stuff, spoken all over the country and so forth, get drunk again? Old Bill turned to me and said, who was his higher power? And so I was convinced when I heard that. There was no hope for me, and probably no hope for anybody else in that room, if we couldn't stay sober as long as Woody had, and then get drunk. But it happens. And I'm not anxious for that to happen to me. So, I'm here for the moment. I'm going to stay here. Not here, not standing all the time. You've got to get rid of me in a few minutes. But without this program, I would not have a life that I have today. To me, it's almost as if I stepped out of one body and into another. Because the whole world is different. But I'm always learning in that process. Just the other day, it was listening to somebody who brought it home to me about that this program is one where you talk about yourself and not the faults of anybody else. And that's what keeps me sober, is keeping me telling my story in bits and pieces about what's happened, what's happening now, and the future will take care of itself. That was always a big worry. So I really appreciate the opportunity to come tonight. Sorry I went from drunk to sober to what happened or what it's like now and back again. But as I say, I didn't know what I was going to say, and as soon as somebody comes up here, I'll remember what I was going to say. Thank you.